This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I am Mira Sivasodhi. In our Health and Living segment today, we're going to be discussing smoking cessation. I mean, May 31st is World No Tobacco Day, and this month, our experts from Sunway Medical Center are in full force to help us manage this problem. Dr. Anand Sachidanandan, our cardiothoracic surgeon, Dr. Christina Lai, a clinical oncologist, and Dr. Anza Elias, an occupational health specialist. Welcome to the show. How are all of you today?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mira.
If you have a question, give us a call. The number is 0377 109 000. You can tweet BFM Radio. You can WhatsApp 0187898899, or you can actually message us on Facebook Live. We're Facebook Live at the moment, and we will be able to answer some of those questions. Tina, our producer, is right in the studio to help you answer some of those questions. So anything to do with smoking cessation, lung cancer, give us a call. Number 0377 109 000. Let's talk about the prevalence of lung cancer here in Malaysia. It is alarming. I mean, I think amongst the men, it's the number two cause of cancer in Malaysia. But in Scotland, I was reading that there seem to be more women being diagnosed with lung cancer at the moment. Now, do you see trends like that here in Malaysia as well?
Perhaps Mira can share some of the most contemporary data we have. Local data, it comes from our National Cancer Registry database. Published in 2016, and this was looking back at the period 2007 to 2011. And over this period, they recorded 10,608 new cases of lung cancer over the five-year period. So that translates roughly to about 2,100 new cases per year, or effectively six new cases each day for the last 5 years. Mm-hmm. And the majority of cases still involve men, and smokers or ex-smokers. There's a few interesting trends that we have noticed from the local data. One is there's an ethnic variation in that if you're Chinese, you are far more likely to develop a lung cancer than a non-Chinese. And the local data, we refer to something as the age standardized incidence. And it's been shown that for a Chinese male, it's about 18 per 100,000 members of the population, which is almost twice that of a non-Chinese male. It's about 7.6. For an Indian male and about 12.6 for a Malay male. And we see a similar trend in women. In Chinese females, the age standardized incidence is around 8 per 100,000 of the population, which is twice that again of a non-Chinese female, which is around 3 to 4 per 100,000 of the population. In terms of the incidence, as you said, it is now the second commonest cancer in men, just surpassed by colorectal cancer. So based on the local data, I think 15.8% of all cancer in Malaysian men was attributable to lung cancer. And colon cancer accounts for 16.3%. And in women, it's the fifth commonest cancer after cancer of the breast, colon, uterus, and ovaries, accounting for about 5 to 6% of all cases. So the second commonest in men, the fifth commonest in women, but overall it's still the leading cancer killer, accounting for maybe one in five of all cancer-related deaths in the country.
Dr. Christina, does it have everything to do with smoking, though?
Well, I think we all know that about 90% of cases are attributed to smoking. But I do see a lot more, I would say, non-smoker getting lung cancer now. I think it's very difficult to explain to patients why, you know. Perhaps we will talk a bit about the risk factors of smoking, of lung cancer. The first and foremost is smoking, okay? The others that we may know of is secondhand smoker, if your husband or your wife smoke, and air pollution, okay? Exposure to radon. Now it's very interesting because we now have a bit of data like people exposed to cooking oil fumes, like chef, you know, high temperature frying, you know, in a poorly ventilated kitchen. Mm. That's a risk factor as well, okay? And of course, genetic predisposition. But of course, the bulk of cause of this lung cancer patients are smokers. Yep.
Do we seem to see an emergence of more women sort of in their 40s who seem to be getting lung cancer and they are not smokers? And I do understand that Cancer Research Malaysia is trying to do studies to understand this trend. I mean, do we know very much, or would you know much about it?
Well, we do see that the young women or even a little bit older women who get lung cancer non-smoker, they tend to be the adenocarcinoma subtype. Okay, and in the majority of these cases, there is a few identifiable mutations that we see. And now we have treatment to target these mutations. So I think I would see a lot more nowadays than I did 5 to 10 years ago. Non-smokers getting lung cancer, especially in women.
Yes. Okay. So let's talk about the different types of lung cancer. How do you differentiate that? Because I understand something called the non-small cell lung cancer. It makes up the most of the lung cancer cases.
Yes.
And what is that?
So lung cancer is divided into two broad groups, okay, the small cell and the non-small cell. And you are right to say that the non-small cell group is the most prevalent one. And within this non-small cell group, there are different subtypes. So there's adenocarcinoma, squamous cell carcinoma, a large cell, and a very small miscellaneous. Okay, this is the one that, you know, I was mentioning that non-smokers tend to get the adenocarcinoma subgroup. Now, how do we differentiate is
exactly.
mainly a pathology thing that the pathologists kind of describe the cell. Basically, traditionally, the small cell, well, as the name says, it's small. And the others are, you know, just distinctly different from the small cell group. So this is, you have to biopsy the lung lesion, the lung mass, and send it to the lab for the pathologist to label which group it falls into. So it has to be diagnosed in the lab by a pathologist.
Okay, and speaking of diagnosis, most of these diagnoses come in late when the cancer has advanced. I think I was reading in the UK, you know, so many are diagnosed in accident and emergency. You go in and you find out you actually have lung cancer and it's so advanced. Is there any way of finding out early, or is there screening? What can you do to ensure that you don't have lung cancer?
Can I just share a bit of data to support what you've just said, Mira? Again, from our most contemporary data, this National Cancer Registry data, to me, the most alarming statistic, never mind that it's the second commonest cancer in men and fifth commonest in women and leading cause of cancer death, we know that at the time of diagnosis, 89 to 90% of cases, the person or the patient is diagnosed at an advanced stage. So at the initial diagnosis, initial presentation, when they first attend a doctor and the diagnosis is made, 9 out of 10 Malaysians, it's at a stage 3 or stage 4. And we are beyond the remit of curable treatment or curable therapy. Lung cancer, as everyone knows, there's effectively 4 stages. When we talk about lung cancer, as Christina said, we're talking mostly about non-small cell lung cancer. It's a fairly complex staging process. We use an international classification called the TNM classification. You've got stages 1 through 4 with subdivisions. And broadly speaking, early stage disease, stages 1 and 2, surgery has the potential to cure the patient. And for more advanced disease, stages 3 and 4, then usually we're looking at non-curative treatment in the form of chemo or radiotherapy, although there can be enhancement of their survival or progression-free survival. So as you rightly say, we need to try and pick up the disease at an earlier stage, and there comes the concept of screening. Screening is effectively trying to detect a disease before one develops symptoms at a preclinical and asymptomatic stage. Screening for lung cancer is not new. It's been done for several decades in the United States, in Japan. They've been doing it with chest x-rays and with sputum cytology, so getting the person to cough up and analyze the sputum, the phlegm. But they found this to be not particularly sensitive, not very cost-effective. And in recent years, there's been a lot of interest globally for screening with a low-dose CT scan. In 2011, there was a landmark trial, the North American Lung Screening Trial, that was published in a leading medical journal, the New England Journal, and that unequivocally demonstrated that if we target the right group, the group that is deemed to be at risk of developing lung cancer, then screening with a low-dose CT scan was shown to be highly beneficial. There was a survival benefit. So that has to be the way forward, to try and pick up the disease at an earlier stage on the premise that we can then provide effective treatment.
So these would be people who smoke?
Yeah, there's the challenge, trying to identify that high-risk group. some of it follows on from what Christina was saying in terms of the risk factors for lung cancer. Most screening programs will target smokers or ex-smokers with a significant smoking history. We advocate here in Malaysia an age group of around 45 to 75 years of age. Targeting older patients is probably not very cost-effective or logical, because if you pick up incidentally a tumour in someone who's much older, chances are that tumour is not going to cause them any bother and they will die of old age or some other illness. Equally, we know the incidence of lung cancer in those under the age of 40 is about 6%. So it's this age group with that history of smoking that we feel is probably the high-risk group.
So what you're saying is when the older person is diagnosed with lung cancer, there's a high chance that person is going to die with the lung cancer rather of the lung cancer.
Yes.
That's what you're saying.
Well, what I'm trying to say is the concept of screening is to pick up the disease before there's any symptoms. Okay. So this is effectively like an incidental finding. We should be targeting, if you pick up a tumour in a very elderly person by chance or by screening, chances are it's biologically less significant.
Right.
And we know the mean life expectancy is about 72 for a Malaysian male. I think it's about 76 or 77 for a Malaysian female. And often they may or may not be fit enough to undergo whatever treatment is required. And yes, so they would die with the lung cancer rather than because of it. Exactly.
Okay. Dr. Anza, you're an occupational health specialist. How do you come into this management? I mean, this management of lung cancer is very multidisciplinary. I think a lot of diseases now involve different people from different backgrounds to actually come together and treat this patient, right? So how do you come in as an occupational health specialist?
I don't treat lung cancer patients, but I prevent them from getting lung cancer. So what I do now is I run a smoking cessation clinic.
Okay.
And we are part of a partner of MQIT services. So MQIT services as integrated services, smoking cessation services, and MOH is the owner of the program. And MQIP services have 10 partners, which include public universities, private hospitals, NGOs, and universities. So that's how I come in. So I run the smoking cessation clinic, and in particular at the workplace, because we know that the prevalence of smokers in Malaysia is about 20%. And out of these 20%, 50% of males, and most males would be working. So that's how we launched a program, smoking cessation program, at the workplace.
Okay, so you're at the hospital, though.
Yes.
So how does this work? You go into the workplace?
Or? Yes, we do, yes. So we have programs, and we go out to, it's called reaching out to the workplace. So we would talk to the HR, we would talk to the insurance companies, and some insurance companies would subsidize some of it, of the treatment and consultation, and that's how we do it.
Okay. So when you actually deal with people in the workplace, what have been some of those conversations like?
Right. The first thing would be the cost, definitely. It's a treatment cost and also the consultation cost. And what I would normally tell the HR or the employers, it is smoking cessation is a highly cost-effective intervention. So in the long run, they would reduce the medical cost of hospitalizations, and reduce cost by reducing sickness absences. So studies have shown that smokers are more likely to have sickness absences. They're more likely, of course, to develop acute illnesses such as upper respiratory tract infections and cardiovascular diseases and respiratory diseases. And at the end of the day, the cost to the company will be reduced if their employees stop smoking.
Okay, actually, that's just five things. I think smoking like affects everything at the moment.
Yeah.
I mean, the more we know, the more we understand that it's far more than lung cancer. It affects a lot of things.
Yeah,
the functioning,
society, yeah.
Exactly, functioning of this, you know, body of ours. So we'll come back and have this discussion. We are talking about lung cancer and smoking cessation. If you have a question for the team from Sunway Medical Center, give us a call. The number is 03 77 109 000. You can tweet BFM Radio. You can WhatsApp 018 789 8899, or Facebook Live your message right now on The Bigger Picture. This is, we'll come back and continue this discussion discussion up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome to our Health and Living segment. In the studio with us from Sunway Medical Center, Dr. Anza Elias. She's an occupational health specialist, Dr. Christina Lai, a clinical oncologist, and Dr. Anand Sachidanandan, a cardiothoracic surgeon. We're discussing lung cancer and smoking cessation. It's never too late. Is it really never too late?
Yes, I think so.
Okay, all right. Because I'm so jaded because when I hear everybody comes in at such late stage when it comes to diagnosis, it makes me very skeptical as to whether or not this is actually effective. Why do you think, Dr. Christina, based on your interaction with patients, why have they come late? If we all know smoking is not the best for you, if we all know 90% of lung cancer cases is due to smoking, why then do they present so late?
I think first and foremost, the symptoms of lung cancer, the signs and symptoms are very common. Most people would think they have a simple chest infection. And of course, you know, you and I have chest infection on and off. So most people, especially smokers, you know, they have a smoker's cough. So they just assume that, you know, it's quite normal for me to have this cough. And by the time they realize something is wrong, this cough is going on for too long, I've started coughing up blood, I should go and see a doctor now, it's usually too late. So first and foremost, I think it's the symptoms. It's very difficult to tease out if this is just a simple chest infection or it's something more serious. And I think secondly, also perhaps it's our culture, you know, we tend to do our own thing when we're sick, just get pop a pill from the local pharmacist and hopefully sleep it off and only see the doctor when it's too late or it's not getting any better. So maybe some cultural factor there as well.
Okay.
And I think last but not least, I think it's this fear that, oh, it could be cancer.
Yeah.
You know, and I think all three of us here would have some experience of that in our practice. Yeah.
Yeah, I think what Christina says is absolutely right. The other thing we see is there's a local study which has shown that the mean delay time from when one develops symptoms to actually seeing a doctor was as long as 60 days. And I think that just underlies the fact that the symptoms are nonspecific. You dismiss it. You're quite common. And another thing is here, even when you do get a diagnosis, a lot of people in Malaysia cross-culturally will avail of alternative treatments. Mm-hmm. Traditional complementary treatments, which I don't really think works in the setting of lung cancer anyways. And so there's that delay as well. Yeah,
Dr. Anza, I'm sure you see. why is it they don't want to come forward?
First of all, they would think that it's very difficult
to kick the habit.
Mm-hmm. And it's because of a nicotine dependence. So it is a medical condition. So someone is addicted to nicotine. So it's not easy because of the content of nicotine in the cigarettes. And that's why they just need to hang on it. So what we would do in a our council would be the motivation to stop, to quit. What are the health benefits of stop smoking? What are the benefits if you are continue to smoke? And we would discuss in a group. If, let's say, we are doing in a workplace, we would discuss in a group and we would explore on what are the benefits of stop smoking, what are the benefits of smoking for now, and then we would ask them whether they are ready to quit or not. So most of the time, some of them would ready to quit, but did not know where to go, and did not have support from healthcare professionals. So that's how we come in. We are partners of MQuit Services. We are here to help anyone who wants to quit.
What does smoking cessation entail?
Right. So what we have here is an integrated service, which is behavioral counselling and also pharmacotherapy if needed. So we would the normal course of service would be around 12 weeks. And we would start with the assessment, the nicotine dependence level. And then we would decide whether the person needs pharmacotherapy. And then we would going on for the behavioral counselling, and then we would explore on the motivation, we explore on the withdrawal symptoms, and then we would look at what are the things that they can do to overcome the withdrawal symptoms.
Okay, we have a question here, very interesting. How do you explain expensive fine cigars? Where do they stand on the spectrum of smoking? Smoking cigarettes versus expensive cigars.
It's still nicotine. So at the end of the day, it is nicotine. And of course, the health effects of cigarettes is not just nicotine; it's also caused by the chemicals in the cigarettes. Yeah. And for now, we know that a lot of chemicals in the cigarettes, and the same goes to e-cigarettes.
We know cigarettes have got more than, what, 7,000 chemicals?
Yeah.
More than 7,000.
Yeah, 7,000 chemicals.
And 100 of them are known to be carcinogens. Yes. Chemicals.
And we know all of this.
Yes. Sure.
I'm just wondering, another thing I'm sure Enza emphasizes to her patients is the financial burden or benefit if you stop smoking, right? Because a pack of cigarettes is like, what, 17 ringgit?
Yeah. So
you smoke a pack a day?
Yeah. So if someone smokes 17 ringgit per day, that would translate into 500 ringgit per month and 6,000 ringgit per year. So that's how much they can save money on that. And the pharmacology treatment and the consultation would be less than that.
Okay. When you say pharmacology, you're talking about medication.
That's correct. All right. Yes.
I think everyone knows that. That it costs a lot. I think the math is, it's there. We know it all. We know how bad it is. But as you said, it's a condition. It's an addiction, and that's something that needs to be addressed. I knew we would hear from LTY. Okay, LTY, what's your question today? Are you there? Hello. Okay, he's not there. Some people would argue that I've been smoking, but I'm fine. I've lived to a ripe old age and I've done well. Dr. Christina, what would you have to say about that?
Well, I think there is a genetic predisposition. So when before a cell becomes cancerous, right, it's bombarded with chemicals or whatever that cause mutation in the DNA of the cell. Now, most of our cells are able to correct that before it goes on to replicate and, you know, and move on. There is something in one particular cell that caused this cell to lose that. That means it cannot correct that mutation. And it just goes on to replicate and then become cancerous. Now, why is it that some smokers can smoke like a chimney and have no problems? There's probably something in them, you know, that they can correct the mutations that smoking chemicals cause. And why would some of us not? You know, we don't fully understand why. But I think the immune system plays a big role. So our immune system should be able to detect that a cell's gone funny and just kill it off before it has a chance to become cancerous. And why would a potential cancer patient's immune system miss out that cell? Well, it's probably multifactorial. You know, there's probably a lot of things to do with lifestyle, lack of sleep, poor diet, you know, that cause that patient's immune system to underperform, so to say, if I can put that in the most simplest term. Alan, do you have anything to add to that?
No. Yeah. I think that's right. It's like most diseases, lung cancer as well, it's multifactorial, isn't it? So we probably all have a different threshold before.
Yeah,
and something at a molecular, cellular level happens.
Yeah, and there is no safe threshold for nicotine. So as in many carcinogens, there is no safe threshold. That's why we emphasize so much on the stop smoking to reduce the risk.
What do you mean by safe threshold?
Meaning, for example, some chemicals, they have certain level where they can cause ill health. For example, the chemicals that we're dealing at the workplace, there are certain levels in many countries. They have act to regulate that. But for carcinogens, we do not have any threshold that to say that at one level it is safe. So that's for carcinogens.
It's just bad.
I mean, you know, in layman's terms, you could make yourself feel better and say, well, you only smoke 5 cigarettes a day kind of thing. But although the smoking intensity and volume does correlate, it does increase the risk. As Enza rightly says, it doesn't mean that if you're a light or infrequent smoker that you can't get lung cancer, for example.
Yeah. So it really depends on your system and how it interacts on a gene level.
Yes.
Diagnosis. So once I come to you, I've got the symptoms. You know, you've spoken about the cough, you've spoken about the blood in the sputum, that sort of thing. How do you diagnose after that?
Well, Alan maybe is better to take this question, because by the time they come to me, they are confirmed to have lung cancer.
I know. I just thought he would open up your sternum and do whatever he needs to do, but obviously not. Go ahead.
No, not always. So the diagnosis, basically, often the patient would have seen their own primary care physician or GP, and usually they would have seen a chest physician, and they would have gone through a proper history taking and an examination. As a bare minimum, a chest X-ray would have been done, which often will show a shadow on the lung, suggestive of a possible tumour or cancer. And sometimes the X-ray may look fairly normal, but if the clinical suspicion is high, then the physician would order a CT scan. And once we have an appearance on a scan that is highly suggestive of a cancer, then the next thing that person would need is a biopsy, which is to get a sample of the tissue. It depends on the location of the tumour. If it's something in the middle of the chest, quite central, then it may be amenable to a scope, a bronchoscopy, and trying to get the biopsy from the inside out. If it's more on the outside of the lungs, the periphery, then usually we will ask our radiology colleagues to do an ultrasound or more often a CT-guided biopsy and take a sample of the tissue. That goes off to the pathologist to give us a histological or pathological diagnosis of cancer or otherwise. Often in parallel with that, we will then need to stage the disease, which means we need to determine the extent of spread, and that usually takes the form of a PET scan, PET, PET scan, positron emission tomography scan, which more or less scans from head to toe and is looking for evidence of if the tumour has spread outside the lung or outside the chest cavity. There's one caveat to that. It's not very good at picking up lesions in the brain. So if we have a suspicion that the patient may have a metastasis spread to the brain, then they would also need an MRI of the brain. So often these tests are done in parallel because it takes a few days for the biopsy results to come back. And then we have a situation where we have a confirmation of a lung cancer, what type. Often there's a lot of molecular testing that is done as well. And then we can stage the disease. And then at this point, it'll determine which treatment pathway that person goes. So if they're early stage 1A, 1B, 2A, 2B, and selected cases of stage 3A, if they're fit enough and they've localized disease, then surgery is the best option, and hopefully they will come and see a surgeon. If they have more locally advanced or metastatic disease, some cases of stage 3A, 3B, 3C, stages 4A and 4B, then there's very little or no role for surgery, and they would see someone like Dr. Christina, an oncologist, for chemo or radiotherapy or immunotherapy or a combination of that.
Okay. So the both of you then sit down and decide the sort of the journey for this patient in terms of treatment?
Yes. We try to employ a multidisciplinary approach to all our patients, yeah.
So it would be the both of you and who else?
There's usually a radiology colleague, okay, and as well as a pathologist. If there's any query about the diagnosis, like I said, the subtype and all that, yeah.
I mean, sometimes it's done in an informal setting, but that's what the concept of a multidisciplinary can involve: the referring chest physician, the thoracic surgeon, definitely the radiologist, who may have done the CT scan or the PET scan. The pathologist is very important, the oncologist, of course, sometimes palliative care specialists. And allied health professionals, you know, for example, a physiotherapist, dietitian, if it's required.
What's patient's reaction like usually upon diagnosis?
I mean, it's probably quite different for both of us.
Yes.
Christina, probably by the time they see me or they see her, they usually have a diagnosis. When they see me or when they see a surgeon, often, obviously, they're quite anxious. They're quite well informed. They would have done some of their own research. But usually they come with the hope, they're hopeful that it is potentially curable, early stage disease. And obviously we look at the scans and the whole picture to determine. So usually it's cautious hope, I think, when they come to see a surgeon.
I think from my personal experience, I think if the patient is a smoker or ex-smoker, by the time they come to see the doctor, they kind of they've braced themselves for a diagnosis of lung cancer, whereas I think the non-smokers tend to be more shocked because obviously, you know,
I did all the right things.
Absolutely,
right.
Yeah. So I see that.
That's quite right.
Yeah.
That's quite right.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. So then, all right. So then I'm sure they feel like, you know, am I to be blamed? Did I bring this upon myself? How do you help them emotionally? Because that also plays a part when it comes to treatment. Am I correct?
Yes. I think... I think communication with your with our patients is very important. I think, you know, like you said, a lot of patients would blame themselves, you know, because I smoke, you know.
You do, Christina?
Huh?
Oh, sorry.
No, she's
sorry.
So he almost fell off his chair there.
I know. So I explain, you know, like to my patients that, you know, we all know, like you, like we've mentioned, discussed this earlier, we know people who smoke all their years and, you know, and live a ripe old age to 92 or 93 and have no problems. And then we have the other spectrum, people who've never smoked, exercise and eat healthily, and yet they get cancer. So I use that to explain to patients, look, it's more than just smoking. Okay. Although we do know that, you know, your smoking habits may have contributed, but it's more than just that one risk factor. And I would say, you know, look, the diagnosis has been made. Let's move forward. You know, do what we can, you know, refer for smoking cessation, get on with treatment, and, you know, not look back and regret. You know, we need to gather your spirits and move forward for treatment.
So we do know what treatment entails. It's a combination of surgery, either chemotherapy, radiotherapy. You said something about immunotherapy. Now, is that something new? Is that something that's more effective?
Yeah. So immunotherapy in the last 3 years has been the most exciting new thing that's happening in lung cancer. So immunotherapy is part of a systemic therapy. By systemic therapy, I mean medicines that are either administered intravenously or orally. I think most people would know chemotherapy as one of the main systemic therapy. But what immunotherapy does, it would stimulate your own immune system, kind of open up your immune system's eyes to recognize that this is a cancer, and kind of like use your own armamentarium to attack the cancer. And we've seen very good results with that, with very tolerable side effects. It's very exciting, obviously. So the only downside with immunotherapy is that it's very expensive. Yep. But the response is very good.
But does it work for everyone?
Yeah, that's the other catch is that it's not suitable for everybody. So there are tests that we would do to see if the patient would benefit from immunotherapy. Yeah.
Okay. So do you still do surgery and then go on to immunotherapy, or how does that work?
Immunotherapy at this stage is reserved for patients at stage 3 or 4, mainly stage 4, really.
Okay. All right. So no surgery, just straight to immunotherapy?
If they're not suitable for surgery, yes. So for the stage 1 and stage 2, the early stages, surgery is still the mainstay of treatment. Now, for whatever reason, the patient may not want surgery or they're not fit for surgery, we would bring in radiotherapy. So we've got now very advanced new machines like stereotactic ablative radiotherapy that we can target the tumour very precisely and hit it with very strong, very powerful radiotherapy rays, and we can achieve a result as good as surgery.
Oops. You have competition, doctor. What are you going to do about that?
Not a whole lot.
The guys are stenting away. You're losing out. Now this stint.
Any vacancies at BFM?
You want to host the health show? Okay, we'll come back and discuss smoking cessation and lung cancer. If you have a question for the doctors from Sunway Medical Center, give us a call. The number is 0377 109 1000, tweet BFM Radio or WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. Well, if you have just joined us, it's our Health and Living segment. The folks from Sunway Medical Center in the studio with us, we're discussing lung cancer and smoking cessation. Dr. Anand Sachidanandan, a cardiothoracic surgeon, Dr. Christina Lai, a clinical oncologist, and Dr. Anza Elias, an occupational health specialist, all in the studio, happy to answer your questions if you have any of them. Give us a call. The number is 03-77-109-1000. You can tweet BFM Radio, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or you can even just Facebook Live us some of the questions, and I'll have the doctors answer them for you. In the meantime, we have Sue on the line. Sue, you have a question.
Yes, I do. My mom is actually a phase 3 cancer patient.
Could you speak up, Sue? We can't hear you very well.
Oh, can you hear me now?
Yes, much better.
Okay, my mom is actually a stage 3 cancer patient.
Okay.
Not lung cancer. I know you guys are talking about lung cancer, but I'm just curious because she was they suggested radiotherapy for her and not surgery. Although we're trying to get them just to remove the tumor, but it's about 12 centimeters long. So I'm guessing that's long, and that's pretty big. Is it because that it's so bad that they can't save her unless they do radiotherapy? Why was that the suggested method?
Where was the tumor, Sue?
Colorectal.
Colorectal. Okay. All right. Thanks very much, Sue. Probably not, if you're not comfortable answering in context of colorectal, but Dr. Anand, perhaps, when is surgery not an option?
Yeah, maybe I'll just keep it more in the context of lung cancer, yes, which is sort of my area. One important thing to emphasize is the treatment is often multimodality. So there are some cases where the patient may need chemo or radiotherapy before surgery. That would be a scenario, for example, if the tumor is quite big and we want to try and shrink it down to make it resectable. There are instances when they will need the chemo or radiotherapy after surgery, depending on the what we call as the final or pathological staging. A tumor, we use a lot of information, the CT scan, the PET scan, sometimes an MRI, to try to determine the resectability of a tumor. And we can apply this to tumor anywhere in the body. And the concept of resectability is whether the surgeon can remove the tumor, the primary tumor, completely and safely. In the context of lung cancer, the tumor could be situated in close proximity to major vital structures, such as the heart, major blood vessels, in which case it may not be technically resectable. If, for example, it is invading the chest wall, we can remove the tumor with part of the chest wall and reconstruct the chest wall. So that is the concept of resectability. And it is largely determined by the anatomical information we have on the scans. We also look at operability, and that is to see if the patient is fit enough for the operation. And here we look at a few important criteria, the age of the patient, their cardiovascular status, the lung function, nutritional status, and something called a performance status. So there are rare instances when a patient has resectable disease. It can be removed completely and safely, but they are deemed to be medically not fit for general anesthesia, or they don't have sufficient lung capacity to tolerate the required operation. And here they may go down a non-surgical route.
But generally, as you said, Dr. Christina, the first and second stage of lung cancer is usually, surgery is usually the first option.
Yes, that's right. Because I think the surgeons are able to remove the lymph nodes as well. And that would give us more information as to how extent the cancer has spread to.
Would you say lung cancer is an aggressive cancer?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yep. Of course, like all the different types of cancer, there is a spectrum. And that's where, you know, we look at things like the cell type, like I said, small cell or non-small cell, and even how well differentiated the cancer cell, that's like how aggressive or the great, you know. So there is a spectrum.
Have we identified a gene in relation to lung cancer?
There's no one specific gene. Okay, but there are, like, again, for the non-smokers, especially the adenocarcinoma subtype, there are a few different mutations that we have identified, and we have medicine, what we call targeted therapy, to target these specific mutations. So that's why it's very important to get, even in people who are not suitable for surgery, to get what we call a tissue diagnosis from a biopsy. Then we can test whether these patients have this type of mutation. And if they do, they are suitable for this targeted therapy. And with the ones that we have now, it's just a pill that the patient would take. And again, we can achieve a very good response with that. You know, we quote patients a 60 to 70% response rate with targeted therapy.
Do you think the cost will ever go down and become more affordable for everyone?
As it is, the cost is coming down, okay? We have more and more options of targeted therapy. So in a way, there is a bit of competition between the pharma groups. And of course, they know that this is a financial burden on the patient. So most of these drug companies have got patient-assisted program where, you know, you buy one and get the second box free, you know, this kind of things, and that helped patients as well. Yep.
You know, Dr. Anza, I'm very curious. When you go into the workplace and you help people to quit smoking, what are some of the first concerns of these smokers?
One of the most common concerns would be withdrawal symptoms, the cravings. So that they are concerned that the one they stop smoking, what are the symptoms that they're going to have? So most of them would have cravings for cigarettes, and some of them would have get irritable very easily. They get palpitations, some dry mouth, and that's how we teach them how to overcome the withdrawal symptoms.
Some of the medication have side effects, and they're harsh. How do you decide who takes the medication and who doesn't?
We assess them of their nicotine dependence level. So it can be divided into high, intermediate, and low. If, let's say, someone is very low nicotine dependence, then behavioral counseling would be sufficient. But for someone who smokes, for example, 20 or more cigarettes per day, then they would need pharmacotherapy. And most of the side effects are tolerable. And for example, for the nicotine chewing gum, the common side effects would be painful jaw, and we would teach them how to chew, not to chew very fast and very slowly, and where to park the chewing gum. This is not the normal chewing gum.
We have a question here. Is puffing an electric pipe keeping the smoke within the mouth? Does it reduce your chance of getting lung cancer? I just love how everybody wants to. what I'm doing is actually all right. It's not as bad as you think. What are your thoughts?
No, it doesn't. Because the chemicals that you are inhaling when you smoke, that can cause cancer. So it doesn't matter whether you blow out immediately or not. That doesn't matter. And of course, we have we call it second smoking, where they have the line of the smoke beside someone with a secondhand smoking. Mm-hmm. That increases the risk as well of getting.
And now we have third-hand smoking as well.
Yeah, on the clothes. Yes, correct. Oh, okay. So those are the things that we need to create awareness for our public. And I think the commitment has to come from us, from Malaysians. And I think we need to work together, private and public and NGOs, to work as a family. So that's how MQIT services are being born for that.
So you're saying we're not doing enough?
No, we're not.
Okay.
No.
Are electric cigarettes less harmful than tobacco? Steve is asking.
No, it is not. So far, as for now, we do not have any sufficient evidence on what are the short-term and long-term health impacts of e-cigarettes. And there are some studies being done whether e-cigarettes are effective or safe for smoking cessation. And my answer is that for now, no sufficient evidence of the effectiveness of e-cigarettes as a smoking cessation tool.
Okay, it's not proven. They say otherwise in the UK, though.
That's true, yes.
So they feel for smoking cessation, it works. But I think we have a larger problem here in that it's not really about smoking cessation.
So let's work on the evidence-based practice.
Sure. Yeah. A lot of smokers quit and then pick it up again. I'm sure you see many of these cases. What's your advice to them?
So keep on trying. So for me, a relapse is not a sign of failure. It's just that in some circumstances, they would smoke. They would have relapse because of stress at work or stress, personal stress. So what we do is we have plan B kind of action. If, let's say, you're stressed, what should you do? Relaxation techniques, breathing techniques. If, let's say, someone asked you to smoke, your friends asked you to go out for smoke, what do you tell them? So those are the escape plans that I tell my patients what to do next.
Okay, what about your advice to the non-smokers? Are there preventive measures against lung cancer?
Stay away from smokers. Full stop.
What about the air pollution? What are we going to do about that?
For the air pollution, so that's why in many buildings and workplace, smoking is banned because we want to reduce the ETS, the environmental tobacco smoke. So it has been, many research show that exposure to ETS, environmental tobacco smoking, also can have high risk of developing cancer as well. So for my advice, stay away from smoking areas.
Okay. Dr. Anand, is it ever too late to stop smoking?
No. I think even outside lung cancer, as we have discussed earlier, a whole plethora of illnesses and diseases are linked to smoking. cardiovascular, coronary artery disease, hypertension, peripheral vascular disease, stroke, chronic lung diseases like emphysema, bronchitis, exacerbation of asthma. So even if we look beyond lung cancer, there are a lot of health benefits to stop smoking at any point.
Dr. Christina, your message on smoking and lung cancer?
Well, I think for lung cancer patients, that they have this fear of treatment. I would advise all the patients out there, you know, just come and see an oncologist or your doctor and have a proper consultation. I think a lot of lung cancer patients, especially stage four, they tend to just give up before they even try because of this fear of treatment. We are moving away from chemotherapy. We don't like to use chemotherapy if we can help it. So, you know, my advice to patients is that come and speak to your oncologist, go through the proper discussion, and don't fear the treatment, because we have more well-advanced treatment that have minimal side effects nowadays.
Very quick question from someone. What is your view on generic drugs for lung cancer treatment?
Okay, I think if it's a legal generic drug, then that helps with cost reduction. But of course, I have patients coming to me from getting generic drugs from different countries, and I think if it's not legal, then we have to be very careful because we don't really know the contents of these drugs. Yeah,
Dr. Anand, your message?
Very passionate about screening. The fact of the matter is that 9 out of 10 cases are being picked up too late, stage 3, stage 4, beyond the remit of curative treatment, and it's a very common cancer. So for those who fall into a high-risk group, 45 to 75 years of age, with a significant smoking history, either a current or ex-smoker, or a family history of lung cancer, or a personal history of another type of cancer, you are at increased risk of developing lung cancer and should give thought for going for a low-dose CT scan to try and detect the disease at an earlier stage.
Dr. Anza, if we want to support smoking cessation in lung cancer patients without judgment and negative sentiments, how do we do that?
So we need to give support to them regardless. For me, what I would always say to my patients, it's not your fault that you're a smoker. It is because of a nicotine dependence. That's why it's not your fault. It's a medical condition, and that's why we can help you. And that's the reason why you can come and talk to us, the healthcare professionals.
Thank you all very much for joining me today. That was Dr. Anand Sachidanandan, a cardiothoracic surgeon, Dr. Christina Lai, a clinical oncologist, and Dr. Anza Elias, an occupational health specialist, speaking to us about lung cancer and smoking cessation on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.